And welcome to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta. Today, we are talking about systemic racism. Our guests are Amelia Parker, Executive Director of Peace Brigades International USA. I'm also joined by UT professors Michelle Christian, an Assistant Professor in the Department of Sociology, and Asafa Jalata, Associate Professor of Sociology, Global Studies, and African and African American Studies at the University of Tennessee. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's start off by just defining a few terms so we kind of have an even playing field. So what do we mean by race? What is that exactly?
Race is really, there is one whom are race, but unfortunately, people who are racists, scholars who are racists, invented races, assuming that there are different races. And when you ask them how many races exist, they can't tell you because they don't exist. But they mainly focus on three races, Caucasoid, Negroid, Mongoloid. But they can count to 100 and 200 because they don't exist. But in reality, scientifically speaking, there is one human race.
Go ahead.
And I think a key idea that particularly sociologists and social scientists and historians and political scientists as well have been pushing is this idea that Dr. Jalata had mentioned, is that race as a category is a socially constructed category, meaning that it's not biological, even though many people think it's this kind of naturalized phenomenon. But as he mentioned, it was historically created by scientists, by philosophers, that was specifically wanting to have a project of, you know, in many ways dividing up the world based upon these created categories. But part of these created categories is that they put racist assumptions behind what it meant to have that category. And then it was hierarchicalized. So those who were in the Caucasoid category were the highest rank category, and those who were in the Negroid category were the lowest rank, and then all the categories in between. And basically, from the 17th century onwards, we've been living with the repercussions of the creation of these categories.
Amelia, what does the racial makeup of Knoxville look like?
Oh, wow. I will say that when we formed the local chapter of Black Lives Matter in Knoxville, we started looking at the demographics of our city, and primarily we were focused on East Knoxville because that's where the largest concentration of the Black population resides. And we found in 2013 that East Knoxville had a population of about 23,800 people, and of that, 70% are Black individuals. And then we went through, you know, a whole number of statistics of how Black residents in Knoxville are impacted in terms of unemployment, et cetera. But in certain parts of Knoxville, our Black population represents a majority. But throughout Knoxville, I haven't looked at the most recent figures, but I think it's around 16-17% is our Black population in Knoxville.
So let's get this term down. What is systemic racism?
Yeah, that's a popular catch term these days. But it's, as scholars, we're excited to hear when our terms that we usually talk about in our own lexicon comes into the popular parlance. But I think a key aspect of systemic racism, particularly from, for example, a scholar like Joe Fagan, who's a sociologist who's been writing a lot about this for the last 30 years, he describes it as every aspect of life is shaped to some degree by kind of the core racist realities which were built into our foundation, particularly as an American society, meaning that all of our institutional structures that we take for granted, to politics, to housing, to economics, to who we choose to marry, choose religion, is shaped in one way or the other by these kind of racialized phenomena.
And how do we recognize systemic racism?
Well, I think a key aspect of recognizing it is the fact of the huge amount of empirical data we have on racialized inequality. And a key thing that I particularly teach with my students in this kind of current, what's commonly called like the colorblind or post-racial era, which is the period after 1965, more or less, where we had the civil rights legislation become enacted, is that kind of like we basically solved the problem of racism, right? But we have continued to see kind of decade after decade extreme disparities in employment, in wealth, in health outcomes, in the criminal justice system. And kind of underlining that is these kind of oftentimes subtle and insidious practices of kind of racism within these systems. And a key idea is that these systems, because they were built on a foundation of racial inequality, continue to reproduce racial inequality without there necessarily needing to have like an overt racist actor or person who's making a racist decision. But it's how these kind of subtle ways of these kind of cumulative outcomes of historical racism shapes contemporary outcomes today.
And I was tweeting about this morning, and someone made an interesting point, which was that they get very little resistance from people when they say systemic racism, but they get a lot of pushback when they say institutionalized racism. So what is the difference there?
Before I go there, let me add some points to what Dr. Christian said.
Oh, go ahead.
In order to understand clearly what systematic racism is, we need to look at history. We need to look at economics, we need to look at politics and psychology, and particularly we need to look at the formation of the United States. When the United States was created, it was based on colonialism, which led to genocide, also slavery, racial slavery. During the certain colonies were created, for example, there was no this much difference between indentured whites and enslaved Africans, because they were working side by side, they were oppressed. But the slave owners didn't like that idea. They gradually wanted to divide this group of people, because if they create solidarity, they would challenge the establishment. Therefore, the idea of whiteness gradually invented and introduced to white in order to allow them certain opportunities. Despite the fact that they were divided into classes, they were at the lower classes, but if they were European, people of European origin, they gradually get access to jobs, opportunities. When they paid all their bills that they borrowed to come here, then gradually they get jobs, they get access to politics, they get to neighborhood. That would allow them generational and intergenerational upward mobility. But for people who were enslaved, who were totally excluded, like Native Americans and African Americans, they invented the racial caste system. This racial caste system first involved slavery. When slavery ended, they created segregation. When segregation ended, they created mass incarceration. So racism has been evolving from time to time. When it evolves, it involves institutions. That's when becoming institutions very important, particularly government institutions that play a very important role on national, local, regional level in reinventing racism depending upon given historical circumstances.
You know, I have one, I think it's very interesting that your followers on Twitter are responding differently to the mention of institutionalized racism rather than systemic racism, and one can only guess, you know, why that reaction is. You know, but my guess would be, you know, once you take the theory and try to find ways to take action on these issues, when you look at institutions are staffed by people we know and, you know, people we grow up with and love. And I think maybe that's what makes folks a little bit more nervous. When we talk about systemic issues, it seems like this large, you know, force that, you know, maybe our goodness shining out of our hearts can combat. But institutions are run by people, and it requires us to address our neighbors and our friends on policies that they're implementing, perhaps, you know, with all of the good intentions, but are having these negative ramifications. So that would be one of my guesses.
Well, and I want to talk to the person who's rolling their eyes and saying, not another conversation about race and making white people feel guilty. So let's address that person. Why is the subject worth discussing? And in this conversation, what do we need to say and what do we need to hear from others?
Well, I think as a society, particularly in this kind of post-civil rights era, we have shied away from talking about race. And I think that's part of the larger problem, mm-hmm. is that we kind of think racism, at least broadly, meaning that nobody's actually a racist and people don't have racist ideas anymore. Therefore, the problem has gone away. And if we have these inequalities, we can explain them by other means. And I think particularly for white folks, we haven't had to think about racism, right? And so we're socialized in an environment where kind of the road is mapped out for us and the opportunities are there, but we commonly don't see them as a history of racialized opportunities, and that we take for granted the neighborhood that we live in, the school that we go to, the church that we attend. We don't maybe necessarily think about, oh, wow, this is a predominantly white school, or this is a predominantly white church. It's the environment which we are in, and we naturalize that environment, as opposed to thinking about, well, actually, segregated communities were created. You know, African Americans and other racialized groups were not allowed to be in certain neighborhoods. We had policies that supported that. You know, where you live depends and shapes where you go to school. So therefore, if you live a segregated community, you're going to go to a more segregated school. And our data on segregation in the school system is unfortunately just as strong during when segregation was codified in our legal system.
And Amelia, you could probably speak to this as well. I mean, people ask, why Black Lives Matter?
Yeah.
Why does that exist?
Yeah. For many reasons that we don't have time for on this call, conversation today. But, you know, just quickly, I definitely think it's, you know, when movements are built, it's built upon so many things that have come before it. It doesn't just come out of nowhere. And it can be so many things that trigger that coming together of energy that people bring. And definitely, you know, the killing of Trayvon Martin was one of the motivating factors that brought so many people together. But I also think it's, you know, the advance in technology and the fact that we're more connected through the internet. And we can see when things happen to us in our own location, similarities in other cities. And so there was, you know, as we're moving into this period where there is more discussion of a colorblind post-racial U.S., there was a growing frustration that, hey, no, there, you know, we haven't moved past. And in fact, you know, when we read Michelle Alexander's book, we learn that this beast of oppression has just taken on a new face, and we need to recognize it. And we had a new, younger generation of folks coming up saying, you know, not in my lifetime. I'm not going to allow this to happen in my lifetime. And also, since this is a new time, I do not feel as constrained as others did, perhaps during the civil rights movement, to contain my emotions and to, you know, compose myself every time I'm in public. And so you saw a completely different type of movement that was built and developed, responding to things that are happening today, but still on the backs of those who came before us.
Well said. And we will be back in just a minute. We are talking about systemic racism. You're listening to Dialogue on WUOT. And you're listening to Dialogue here on WUOT 91.9 FM, your NPR news station. My name is Victor Agreta, and I am here with my guests Amelia Parker, Michelle Christian, and Asafa Jalata. We are talking about systemic racism. We want to take your calls. The number to call is 974-5050. You can also tweet at us at WUOT FM, and we have a Facebook post up as well where you can throw some questions in there. So we're going to continue talking about, let's talk for a moment about privilege. That is, of course, tied into all of this. What is privilege? What does it look like? How does someone know, how can they recognize privilege if they have it?
Well, I think privilege comes in lots of different varieties. And, you know, as individuals, we hold different kind of social identities, and our different identities are connected to these kind of larger social systems, whether it be around race, class, sexuality. For purposes of this discussion, we think about race, you know, as we've been talking about, you know, race emerged as this hierarchical category that was created. Therefore, those who were given the white category in that were then allotted specific privileges and benefits that those who were not allotted. And that was, you know, institutionalized and codified in our legal systems and bled into all these other institutions. And those foundations have maintained themselves. And so, you know, if you're white, you have this privilege of most likely having these opportunities that are available to you that have historically have not been available to other racialized groups. And a lot of the times you don't have to think about it as well. So part of particularly being white is the normalization of whiteness, meaning you don't kind of wake up in your morning and you're not fully aware of like how racialized experiences are shaping your world, as opposed to African Americans and other groups who have to deal with those sets of circumstances. So there's this idea of when you're born into whiteness, you're born to belong, meaning like your kind of legitimacy is never questioned. It's just there.
And speaking of that, we were talking during the break about citizenship, even bestowing citizenship among African Americans. What's the history there?
They were denied citizenship, in fact, until recently, 30 years ago, they were excluded despite the fact that they worked day and night to build the economy of this country. They were, for African Americans, the racial caste system was created in order to exclude them from opportunity. So if you didn't have citizenship, you didn't have access to economic opportunities, educational opportunities, political opportunities, you would be out. So you would be remained at the bottom of society for many centuries. So that one still reflects itself because, as I mentioned before, privilege produces more privilege. Disadvantage create more disadvantage. When people who get access to opportunities get gradual improvement, people who were kept outside, they will face disadvantages in quality of education, in getting access to jobs, in access to health services. In leaving certain neighborhood will be kept. They are kept out of privilege. So citizenship rights plays a very important role for its inclusion. If you have citizenship rights, you will be. You are included. If you don't have it, you would be excluded. So African Americans excluded until 1960s almost from having citizenship rights.
And that's what strikes me about this conversation, because some people say, well, it's difficult to talk about systemic racism, but there's a lot of history here. And B, you know, for people who say we shouldn't look at race, that we're in this post-racism world, that discussing race is itself racist or at least divisive, I mean, what do you say to that? Because it seems like if there is a problem, not talking about a problem is not a solution to that problem, right?
Most definitely. And also, you know, one thing that I often say in my work here in Knoxville and wherever is that it's time to heal. You know, the folks who are out there calling for change are ready for this country to heal, and we're not able to do that until we all collectively have a clear sense of our history and a clear sense of what needs to be changed structurally, systemically in our country in order to truly, you know, build a nation that works for all of us and guarantees the rights of all of us.
You know, to that point, after protests in 2014 in Ferguson, Missouri, the Department of Justice looked at data from arrest records to penalties handed down by the courts. They determined that in nearly every, quoting now, nearly every aspect of Ferguson's law enforcement system, African Americans are impacted a severely disproportionate mm-hmm. amount. And that report included racist emails sent by the police, municipal court supervisors, repeated examples of bias in law enforcement, and a system that seemed to be built upon using arrest warrants to squeeze money out of residents. And this was just found in one city, of course, because of a spotlight that was on that city. How prevalent, though, is this? And do we even know how prevalent this is?
Well, there are definitely national criminal justice groups who are doing the work. and I do not have their reports in front of me, so I can't tell you the breadth of those numbers. And I would say it doesn't stop there. You know, we as a country have, you know, visits regularly by UN committees who are issuing reports, not only about disparities in our education system, policing, you know, looking at the high rate of poverty and the disparities along race. Of those numbers, these reports are constantly being produced on the U.S.
Yeah, and I just want to add, you know, those DOJ reports are really important, and they did really systemic analysis, I think, of at least over 20 different police departments. So I'd highly encourage folks to look at those reports, hopefully if they're still online. But yeah, the Ferguson report, you know, I teach that in my class, and the systemic nature of how kind of these small to large kind of racist acts kind of were cumulative over time, and how a community, as opposed to being protected, was basically looked at as a force of revenue. And I think that's also part of larger issues of race and politics and government as well, and how we fund our cities and how we fund our school systems, that kind of, as we were kind of saying at the break and other times, all these things are so interconnected. But, you know, I think racialized policing and mass incarceration, as several scholars have been documenting for a long time now, you know, goes back to times of enslavement and how that has unfolded more or less over time, as Dr. Gelada has mentioned, and kind of evolved in these different eras, as Michelle Alexander has talked about, as a form of social control.
Let me add on why we want to discuss about racism at this time. Racism is a kind of social cancer. Societies that have that kind of cancer is not healthy. It's very good for all people who are involved to discuss the problem of society rather than trying to deny and try to find a solution. If people openly discuss these issues, they can find really solutions. At least people who are unintentionally racist, who are willing to understand, will learn more, and then people jointly can find solutions, because rather than saying it doesn't exist, when in reality exists, it exists. When in the United States today, millions of people are in prison because of their skin color, spending a lot of money and building prisons rather than building schools, it is very beneficial for all people who are involved to understand these problems and find solutions.
And there are people who are playing devil's advocate out there. There are pundits like Larry Elder who argue that systemic racism doesn't exist. He says that regards to education, that poorer families, especially minorities, have an easier time with scholarships, loans, and grants because of their economic eligibility. So what does the data show? Is that true?
Well, I think you have to look at kind of these discursive justifications that are commonly used to kind of downplay racism. And as you actually see over time, these kind of cultural arguments or other arguments to justify kind of inequalities actually go back to kind of the beginning of racism, when it was first like their own inferiority, biological inferiority, is why individuals are not able to get these empirical outcomes. And that's involved particularly now with these kind of cultural arguments. And I would say that if you look at the history of cumulative advantages and how particularly white Americans are most likely to live in households with higher income, parents have higher wealth equity, therefore go to better schools, therefore get access to college, therefore get access to the skills to find job placement after college, are networked into a community that helps them get those jobs. All of those are the myriad of ways where whiteness advantages our society today that are not looked upon in that way, right? They're not constructed as a form of you know, racism anymore, although the systems that we created have produced those outcomes. And so I think it's really important to, you know, go backwards and look at all these structural barriers that communities of color face in achieving these types of outcomes.
And one of Elder's primary points, too, is that 75% of African-American children are born out of wedlock. And he claims that that is the primary cause of so many of these other issues. I mean, what would you say to that?
I would think that, you know, it's much easier to find these kind of simplistic answers to that as opposed to looking at, for example, the health disparities that African-American women face in getting access to health care, getting access to prenatal care, even the health, their health, giving birth. And then you have to look at the larger, again, environment. Then if you're focusing on this activity, then you're not focusing at how schools are underfunded. You're not focusing at the continuation of segregated communities. You're not focusing on the criminalization of space that Dr. Jalad and other, Amelia were talking about. So it comes into kind of a pundit-y, like political answer that, you know, appeases a particular population that allows you to not look at this larger structural environment that, you know, has systemically produced these outcomes. And then, as Amelia said, we can't have a discussion about it. And then we can't also begin to really heal from, like, you know, racism as a cancer as our society that, you know, we have not fully come to terms with as Americans today.
Yeah, one thing that pops into my mind is when we look at the U.S. in kind of a late 19th century view, and we talk about the oppression that Black families were facing during that time, but people have a easier time understanding the picture that you're painting, and they don't bring up single parent households, and they can begin to envision Jim Crow and lynchings, and they can begin to envision, you know, how the institution of slavery tore away families, and you know, what the Black experience might be then. But when you put it into a modern context and you give the same numbers of number of incarcerated Black men in this country and, you know, all of the statistics that Michelle just mentioned in terms of education, still people struggle to, you know, imagine that perhaps these issues, perhaps the over-policing of Black communities has led to those statistics that they're holding up rather than something, you know, just innately being wrong with Black people. And that's, you know, really to engage in a conversation on race and racism, you have to enter that conversation by, you know, kind of relieving yourself of any assumptions that any race of people is inherently bad. And once you kind of lose that assumption, then you begin to look for real answers to why, you know, people are living in the situation that they're in.
As I like to remind my kids, correlation is not causation, right? And let's drill down into some specific things. Racial inequality has been researched in areas like housing, employment, education, and health. So in housing inequality, we are more than a generation removed from Jim Crow laws. In fact, there were, you know, that was a time in which a Black family moving into a neighborhood could have been legally prohibited. So let's explain some things that some people might not be familiar with. What is redlining?
In fact, I would like to go beyond that. During the last decades of the 19th century, when African Americans start to move to different cities, for example, like Cleveland, many other cities, at the beginning, people were not excluding African Americans, they were accepting them. Gradually, as scientific racism started to blossom, as at the end of the first Reconstruction in 1877, when the government started to allow segregation and these kind of activities, people start to segregate African Americans. And during this time, the banks also started to start to engage in redlining, saying that these people who are living that kind of area cannot borrow money. Whenever people move to certain areas, the real estate people go in there and tell them that, if, for example, if African Americans are living in white areas, they agitate them so that they can move out by giving them more money. And they start to encourage people to engage in white flight. So it becomes very lucrative business. So banks start to engage in redlining.
Yeah, just to kind of build off of those points, I mean, I think I know when I teach this in my class, students are kind of amazed to realize just how institutionalized something like racism in our housing system was, particularly if you look at the Home Owners Loan Corporation maps and their influence on the FHA and Veterans Administration on who they would give loans to. So I encourage folks to go look at these maps, which now have been digitized. And we here at Knoxville have our own redlining map. And you see literally neighborhoods blocked off by color, and the color, particularly if you're a red color, most likely designated close low income status and particularly African-American communities. And what's fascinating and an example of the continuation of how racism reproduces is that those same neighborhoods that were outlined in those maps continue to be our racially segregated neighborhoods today and or influence different forms, as Dr. Gelada talked about, white flight. So you can, for example, look at the Sequoia neighborhood here in Knoxville and see that that's still the most highly desirable community to develop, and that was state-sanctioned, institutionalized, that they got funding to do that.
Wow. And of course, we'll get into this after this next break, but we want to talk about how property rights leads to educational opportunities, leads to health outcomes. All of these things are, of course, interconnected. You're listening to Dialogue on WUOT. My name is Victor Agreta, and we will be back in just a moment. And welcome back to Dialogue. My name is Victor Agreta. I am joined today by Amelia Parker, UT professors Michelle Christian and Asafa Gelada, and we are talking about systemic racism. And we encourage you to call in or tweet at us. Our Twitter handle is at WUOTFM. The phone number to call is 974-5050. And we were just talking before the break about housing. We talked about redlining. And let's dig a little bit into this as well. I saw a statistic, this is from a Stanford report, that says less than half of black families, 41%, and Hispanic families, 45%, live in owner-occupied housing as of 2014. For white families, that number is 71%. So when we talk about putting numbers around things, that's the sort of thing that we're talking about. What is an approach to a solution here? What can we do about that? You know, we're talking about banks. We're talking about a lot of interconnected pieces. So what can we do about that?
Well, there are several things, right? There are policy initiatives that can be initiated. There are, but also it's also looking at what is the end goal. So in the Movement for Black Lives, part of our focus has been on building communal wealth in our communities. But the issue you brought up is essentially about individual wealth and wealth that's passed on through families. And that's largely how many American families have built and maintained their wealth over generations. So a couple of different issues, but I'm going to talk about the communal wealth piece and how, you know, as a community, we can support addressing this generational poverty that has resulted from, you know, systemic injustices over time. And so looking at, you know, for instance, if we just look at Knoxville, in Knoxville currently there's a shortage of affordable housing, and largely the policies that have been put in place are to, you know, support the efforts of developers to rehab single family homes for owner occupiers. And that's going to be at a certain, you know, price point, and that will, you know, impact a certain demographic. But when you're talking about a community, if we're looking at East Knoxville, that hasn't received investment from the city in just decades, I mean, it's really just decades, then you are dealing with a different population that's not, you know, they're not ready to take on a mortgage tomorrow. Communally owned property is one way that you can build wealth in an area that has been underfunded, but not leave out those who are not able to, you know, individually take on a mortgage. you know, granting over public properties to nonprofits who can manage that, who can design and implement with the community economic development opportunities that then create jobs locally. There are ways that we can reinvest in parts of our community that we know haven't had investment in quite some time without purely following an economic model that kind of continues to aggravate that class divide that's already there.
Yeah, and just to kind of jump in and highlight the points Amelia spoke about, I think the wealth disparity is one of the strongest empirical indicators that we have that has really sustained itself, particularly because it accumulates over time. Like, more wealth brings about more wealth. And just to kind of give some more statistics, like, based off of Urban Institute data, between 1983 and 2010, the average family wealth for whites was six times that of African Americans and Hispanics, and that was exacerbated with the Great Recession in 2008, where whites empirically lost around 1% of their wealth. Were African Americans lost 23%, and Latinos lost 25%, and that's already the dwindling wealth that they had. And I think the issues that Amelia brought up regarding kind of more moving more towards communitarian forms of wealth, and also kind of community land trusts, which I know some neighborhoods are doing, are also an important innovative way to kind of get beyond these individualized wealth models that we have that have historically created these racialized inequalities. But one more thing about wealth I want to highlight is just how important it is for transformative opportunities. We call it a transformative asset because wealth allows you kind of a safety net that if you experience a crisis, whether it be medical or the housing crisis or something happens to your family, you're able to access that wealth, or you lose your job. And you're more likely, if you have wealth, to know other people who also have wealth. And so if you're in a crisis and your wealth is depleted, you might be able to reach out to other folks. And so, and that all is kind of built on these larger racialized inequalities.
The issue of housing involves quality job, to find a good job. In order to get a good job, you need education. So it requires a lot of things. The policies should involve education, educating young people, helping them to get quality jobs. Once they get quality jobs, they can buy their home. So it's a very complex one. The government involved in creating imbalances between the white society and other society. So the government has responsibility to redress those past mistakes or even present mistakes so that all groups of people get equal access to opportunities, including housing.
And one thing I want to add, which I find is really important to bring up as well, is that, you know, scholars have been talking about that particularly African-American communities face what's called a segregation tax, that even if they're able to attain wealth and then buy a house in the community, particularly a more integrated community or white community, then some of the scholarship, you know, coming out today has said that once a neighborhood turns 20 to 30% African-American, then whites will leave that neighborhood. And then basically, African-American households are paying the price of segregation because as whites leave the neighborhood, then other whites don't want to move into that neighborhood, therefore depleting the cost of the price of their housing. So if they try to sell their housing, then their housing is no longer worth the value that they bought it. So it's this vicious cycle.
Wow. And this dovetails nicely into employment. And I want to talk for a minute about affirmative action. First of all, what do we mean by affirmative action, and has it helped?
Well, I would say that we've moved beyond affirmative action, or at least we're trying to move the conversation beyond affirmative action. But historically, what it has meant is essentially what has just been said was the U.S. government taking positive steps forward and addressing, remedying the effects of you know, racialized policy that they've had in place since the founding of the country. So it can, you know, it can impact college admissions, it can impact can impact decisions on where you know, just government is going to invest its money. But in terms of moving forward, you know, and this is, an exciting new idea that not, but a lot of people are calling for a universal basic income. And that takes the affirmative action conversation a bit further, and says, you know, that there are, in my view, it's really a human rights framework that's being used to address these issues, and saying that, you know, a government should ensure that the basic needs of the community are provided for, and this universal basic income is one way that we can provide that. And then addressing past harms can be done through a form of reparations, where that income is increased for you know, members of our community that are a part of those historically oppressed groups. So I would say the conversation's kind of expanding these days.
Well, absolutely. I noticed Ta-Nehisi Coates actually had a great article on this mm-hmm. a few years ago in The Atlantic about reparations, which is well worth the read for anyone who's interested. Dr. Gelato, I'm also interested in incarceration rates and how incarceration is hindering employment.
Once you are incarcerated, when you go out, even if you are released, you would lock out. You are not allowed to be, because you have a criminal record and nobody is going to be interested to hire you. So you are going to be perpetually excluded from opportunities, from getting jobs, from going to school. And many people are going to see you as a criminal. So that would limit your chance of getting jobs.
Yeah, and just to add on that, you know, having a quote-unquote felony record is one of the few remaining kind of institutionalized discriminatory acts we still have in our kind of legal system, and that, you know, you're excluded from public housing, you're excluded from getting certain types of jobs, and you're excluded from voting. So you're no longer franchised. And if you have a racialized criminal justice system, then you're single-handedly kind of excluding a whole group.
In fact, I was surprised to find that there's no federal law against asking an applicant if they're a felon or even if they have a criminal history. So obviously that plays into this as well, right? Do we have any numbers on that in terms of employment and incarceration? I mean, it seems like these two are tied hand in hand.
Well, I think there's some really good studies out there that have looked at, you know, the linkage between kind of the mark of a felony record and what it does in your ability or lack thereof of finding employment. And I know there's been much discussion about, for example, the African-American unemployment rate going down. And you can look at that as an empirical indicator. But I think what's more important, though, is to look at still the gap and disparity between white unemployment and African-American unemployment. And traditionally, unemployment will go down for all as we have sustained job growth, which we have. But what I think is not talked about in this larger kind of political narrative right now is both that gap and the sustaining of that gap, but also particularly unemployment for young African-American men. So if you look at, you know, data that I was looking at from about 2010, you have young Black men had an unemployment rate of 30%, where young white men had 15.6. And so once you kind of also get into some deeper levels of regarding the challenges, particularly of young African American face, of how they get criminalized and the perceptions that they have, particularly when they go for jobs and seek jobs with particular types of employers, and how the role of, you know, maybe internal biases play in that. And there's, you know, work by sociologist William Julius Wilson has looked a lot about how particular employers look at kind of young Black males when they come and apply for jobs.
Well, we're getting close to time, but we are taking your calls, 974-5050. One thing that it struck me is that all of these things are, of course, connected. This is like a big ball of multiple strings, and if you try to tug at one piece, you find yourself getting wrapped up in another one. Just to tie some things together for our listeners, funding of education, for example, happens through taxes. And if property taxes are set up through the value of homes in that area, then you can sort of see where we have a problem both with ownership, both with the loans, and then I was curious if any of the subprime mortgages, if that played into ownership, home values, and that sort of thing. What was the sort of follow-on effect of that?
Yeah, well, I think some of the data coming out particularly was looking at how communities of color were targeted for subprime lending. You see that they were targeted and kind of offered these really precarious, not good loans. And they're also, targeting a sector that also had been excluded from the housing market for decades, right? So the desire to buy a home very much was there. And then they were the first groups of communities also to lose their home. So, the borrowers of color were twice as likely to lose their home. And the National Community Reinvestment Coalition study particularly found that white and black testers who would go out and look for, again, the similar audit studies that we've seen, who try to apply for a loan during this period as well, we see similar disparities on what type of mortgage they got based on race.
Okay, so we've got a few minutes left. I'm interested, Amelia, maybe you can answer this one. Let's say I'm an HR manager and I'm hearing this today and I'm saying I want to make a change. What are some things that I can do?
Oh, so many. From recruitment practices to looking at personnel policies in place that are going to impact current staff, having some sort of we have one thing that we've grown accustomed to in our workplaces is a sexual harassment policy and a whole process in place. If we feel like we've been harassed, what we can do, putting those things in place for all of your vulnerable staff members. On this call, we're talking about racial minorities. So putting a process in place for racial minorities, if they feel like they've experienced racism in the workplace, who they can talk to, how they can resolve it, that's helpful. And just be creative about how you can build a more diverse work staff, recruit folks in, but also maintain a workplace that's welcoming and respectful of those of color on your staff.
Dr. Gelada, have we made progress in the past 100 years?
Let me put it this way. There has been change in the continuity. I think that's a better one. Now, apartheid or Jim Crow laws or direct institutional racism to some degree has been dismantled, but there is indirect institutional racism which has almost a similar impact on minority groups, which is very difficult also to prove it. It's a very hidden one. It's not clear. So the challenge is going on. Nowadays, this kind of practices are hidden under the ideology of color blindness, despite the fact that Martin Luther King used color blindness to eliminate racism. Now, some racists are using that one to perpetuate racism. So the challenge is still there.
And we've got about 20 seconds. Would any of you say that minorities are on an even playing field at birth compared to whites?
No.
No.
The data does not support that assertion.
The empirical data does not support that.
All right. Okay. Well, we have been talking about systemic racism. This is Dialogue. I want to thank all of my guests, Amelia Parker, Executive Director of Peace Brigades International USA, Professors Michelle Christian and Asafa Gelada. Thank you for joining us today. This has been a production of WUOT News. Our producer is Greg Hill, and I am Victor Agreta. Thank you for listening.